today we are starting something. We're beginning a series of, we're going to study the book of Hebrews. You know, we call it a book. It's not a book. Actually, technically speaking, it's, we think, probably a sermon. And just so, let me give you a little brief overview of New Testament, if I can. We got Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, right? These are the guys who wrote stories about Jesus. Then we got Acts of the Apostles, which is actually by the same guy who wrote Luke, who tells us, it's history too, tells us what happened after Jesus is gone. It's the story of the apostles, the people who followed Jesus. Then we have letters from Paul. These are a whole bunch, from Romans to Philemon. Okay? Then there's some other letters, some other guys wrote. James, Peter, John, Jude, right? Hebrews comes right between. It's sort of a it's a separator, if you will, between letters from Paul and letters from other dudes. You have Hebrews right in the middle of there. And the reason, I think, that we put it there is because we don't know who wrote it. We know it wasn't Paul. At least some people think it was, but I'm pretty sure the majority of scholars don't think it was Paul that wrote it. We don't know who wrote it. We know who wrote some of the other stuff. We know who wrote that. We don't know who wrote Hebrews. But we do know the audience. This is primarily, we think, written to second-generation Christians. Whereas, take Paul's letters, right? This guy would—he was, you know, one of the guy we've talked a little about. Paul. He was the guy that saw Jesus on the road, midline, and converted, and then he becomes this like super evangelist. Well, what he would do would come to town, he'd preach, evangelize, convert people, and all that, and then he'd leave, and then he'd write letters. Within, usually within a decade of being there. This is written a little later to people who they've seen their parents, probably, or older siblings at any rate, struggle with the faith. They've seen them suffer because of what they believe. And now they're somewhat tempted to leave, abandon the faith, and go to, well, in this case, an old, like the Old Testament religion, the temple sacrifice and all that. And it's a sermon. It's written, it's full of sort of theology. The writer will sort of be talking all these theological things, and then he breaks it down really practically. Here's what you need to do right now because this is true. And so it's a sermon. In fact, he calls it, he says in chapter 13, he calls what he says, this book, we call it a book of Hebrews, calls it a word of exhortation, which is exhorting you to change, be this way because of that. So it's a sermon. What it is. And again, the issue, the theme throughout is that Christ is superior to the Old Testament religion, the temple system and the sacrifices. And this is because that's the temptation. These people are tempted to go back to doing things that way because following Jesus was just too hard. Now, I just want to point out that if we're going to understand the book and make the book apply to us, we need to be honest. I don't think any of us in the room, and if you do, please see me, we can talk. I don't think any of us want to go back to building altars and killing sheep on them. I don't think we go, oh, following Jesus is too hard. I'm just going to slaughter a goat, right? That's not. But what are we? We are tempted, I think, to abandon Jesus in favor of other things. We are tempted to abandon Jesus for the sake, sometimes, of neo-spiritual stuff. It might be sort of Eastern religions or popular. It's interesting, I was just talking to somebody yesterday, the Scandinavian countries, it's funny. I always do this when I'm talking about Scandinavian countries because I see the three of them sticking down from the wall. Anyway, sorry. The Scandinavian countries, they are the most secular countries right now on the planet. So as far as cultures, they are the most atheist that you can get. And are now beginning, you're seeing a rise of Norse, Viking religions. People going back and trying to worship Odin and Thor, right? Because I think there's this inherent, we need something. So maybe that's easier. So we might abandon Christianity and turn to that. Or secularism. That's a big one right now. This growing idea of, you know, we can do this on our own. We don't need Jesus. It's easier. We can all get along in this system. Or, on the opposite, maybe rugged individuality. Like Rambo, right? I just need a mountain and a knife and leave me the heck alone. I can do it alone. Right? I don't need Jesus. That might be, or control. There's a lot of fears. There's a lot of things to be afraid of. Frankly, following Jesus means I'm wandering around sometimes in the dark. But I can control that. I can wrap my hands around it. I can make darn sure that my life never has to be threatened by anything in any way. So we might go there. We can see that in power politics often. We might abandon Jesus for wealth. You know, I'm only happy if I have a lot of stuff. Sex, it's a big one in our culture. You know, I know Jesus says, but I'll have more fun over here. I mean, these are legitimate things that we, I think, in our era, in our culture, are tempted to abandon Christ in favor of. And so this book is about Christ is better than whatever you're tempted to go back to. So as we go, and this is going to be probably an 18-week series, unless something changes, and Chris and Daniel are both going to be kind of helping as we go through it, so you'll get to hear voices other than my own, which is good. And as we go, though, we want to kind of bring these things back, and we'll pull different things up as we go and say, well, here's something that we may be tempted to return to or go to instead of Jesus, so let's examine it. So that's kind of our method as we go, and of course, you'll learn a lot of Old Testament temple sacrifice stuff because that's in here too. So I'm going to read Romans chapter 1 today. I will just read through it and then we'll talk about it. So verse 1 starts out, long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets, but in these last days he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed the heir of all things, and through whom he also created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature, and he upholds the universe by the word of his power. After making purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, having become as much superior to the angels as the name he has inherited is more excellent than theirs. For to which of the angels did God ever say, you are my son, today I have begotten you? Or again, I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. And again, when he brings the firstborn into the world, he says, let all God's angels worship him. Of the angels, he says, he makes his angels winds and his ministers a flame of fire. But of the son, he says, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of uprightness is the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness beyond your companions. And, he says, you, Lord, laid the foundation of the earth in the beginning, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you will remain. They will all wear out like a garment. Like a robe, you will roll them up. Like a garment, they will be changed. But you are the same, and your years will have no end. Which of the angels has he ever said, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet? Are they not all ministering spirits sent out to serve for the sake of those who are to inherit salvation? Let me pray. Jesus, you are the greatest. Be with us as we look into your word. Open our hearts, our ears, and have us hear what you want us to hear as we study it. It's in your name. Amen. Now, there's a lot of stuff here, obviously, about angels. But I want to point out something. The point of this is not to talk about angels. The point of what we just read is really to talk about how great Jesus is. Right? Look, over and over, what we see in these quotes from the Old Testament are, you're my son, angels are going to worship you. He uses the angels, but he enthrones the son. Right? That's what's going on. And these are quotes from the Old Testament. And I need to pause and explain something. We'll get back to this. But something I just want you to know, it occurred to me as I was studying each chapter. I sometimes hear people say, well, you know, this is so old, right? I mean, it was written, and it's been changed, and it's been You don't know what the original even said. How can it, it's not trustworthy. I hear this sometimes. And I just want to let you know, there are, I'll be honest, I'm aware of several of the oldest versions that we have of the things, right? And there are some variations, like, wait a minute, why is there a comma in this one and not in that one? So there are some differences, but they're all very minor. And here's what's really important to know. We know they had a Greek version of the Hebrew Old Testament that this guy who wrote this down was reading. Okay, it was translated from Hebrew to Greek. He used it. Right now, I have one. We have the exact same version of the Old Testament that this guy was reading. So when people say, oh, it changes so much, it's all been changed around, it hasn't, okay? I'm just saying, don't let somebody tell you that unless they know Greek and Hebrew. Just don't. It's bogus. Sorry. I have to say that. So, it doesn't work that way. It's not the way it works. But this is not about angels. This is about the supremacy of Christ. This is about Christ's superiority over angels. So that's kind of what I want to focus on more than angels will pop up as we go. But mainly, this is about Jesus. And that's what we're going to talk about. But before we even go there, the first place I want to sit is in the first line in this letter, this book, the sermon. God spoke. I find it interesting, you know, the very first words of the Bible in the beginning, God spoke, right? But this from the beginning time, God has spoken. That's what this guy confirms even now. He says, long ago, in various ways, God spoke, right? The point that he's getting to is that, and now, it's even better, he spoke to us through his son, not just the prophets, the angels, and son, right? That's the point. But I just want to sit on that for a minute. God spoke. This world can be a rough place. Unknowns come along. People are mean. Heartbreak, disappointment. Just this week, I have never been good at keeping up with people from my past, but this past week, thanks to Facebook, I have a little bit. And this week, I lost two guys I graduated high school with. And I mean, you know, I'm not that old. And these were not race car drivers. This seizure playing basketball, one guy possibly had a heart attack. I mean, it's out of the blue. And it kind of is, you know, wow, these guys are my age. School together, you know, it's heavy. And every one of us can have, that's minor. I mean, in the room, trust me, there are some heavy, heavy, heavy stories about heartache and sorrow and grief. And like, what in the world? Viktor Frankl wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning about his own story in a concentration camp in the Nazi Germany. And I mean, it's a heartbreaking story. And the whole point that he's trying to come to is that through all of this suffering, we must be able to find meaning toward the end of it. And it's good, and I agree with his point, but take a little issue, because what he doesn't say is that the God who is ultimately made us, first of all, right? I mean, with his hands, if you'll let me use that metaphor, he created us completely. He is sovereign over whatever that darkness is completely. He is. We can't say he's not. We can't say it's like, you know, that World War II caught God off guard. He's on the throne. He made it. And he's the God who leads us through it, right? All of this is true. And this God has said to us, this is who I am. This is who you are. And this is the world that you live in. He has spoken. This is incredibly comforting. This is, we are not alone. We're not left to go, well, I don't know what the meaning of this is. The Maker has told us, or given us hints at least, given us whatever we need to know to get through it, he has given to us. God has spoken. This is a comfort. But, always but, another shoe. But it's also challenging. Remember that conversation we looked at this a few weeks ago? Conversation between Pilate and Jesus, and Jesus says that thing about all who are of the truth know my voice. And Pilate's like, what is truth anyway? Right. So he makes that comment, what is truth? Because I think there's a part of Pilate's trying to weasel out. Right? It doesn't really matter. There's no truth. It's sort of where he's going with that. But what if God has spoken, like if God has actually spoken, then there is truth. And it's a truth that our Maker says about all of us. And there's something there that we have no choice. We have a choice. I suppose we can refuse. But he says you need to align your life according to the manual. I have spoken. God, if our Maker speaks to humanity, that's a challenge to us. See, we live in this culture. It's secularism is probably the best word. It's this growing idea that we can do this on our own, right? That religion should have no real voice in the public arena. And hey, that's attractive. In some ways, let's just be honest, to be able to coexist and radical Muslims will try to kill me, and I won't be telling people who they can and can't be married to, and everybody just kind of gets along, and nobody has to be offended by anybody. Sure, that's attractive. Let's be honest, and that's what secularism aims at. Okay? But if God has spoken, and he speaks to humanity, and he says, humanity, I made you. This is what I made you for. Work. See, and it's interesting because secularism is sort of a sense of we can all come together and do this on our own. There's the other, and that's individualism. Right? I live on a mountain with a knife. I don't need nothing. I can do this all by myself. And both, and it's interesting because ultimately we see these in the 2016 campaign season. We see one side that's saying, everybody's growing really a pot. We'll make this work. We'll hold hands and sing kumbaya. Everybody's going to love each other. It's going to be wonderful. And we see another extreme on the other side that's saying, everybody stay out of my life. I just want everybody to leave me the heck alone and let me do what I want. You are none of my business. I'm the only thing that's business to me. And both of these, we can do this all on our own, and I can do this all on my own, are a denial of God saying, I am your master, you will do what I say. That's what happens. That's why it's challenging that God speaks. And of course, this is also a difficult thing in our culture, because we live in this relativistic age, right? And we all want to say, you know, when you can believe whatever you want to believe, and I believe what I want to believe, and we love each other, and it's all great. And that's fine, until you realize that if somebody is driving over a cliff, you don't need to go, well, I don't want to offend them. Right? Is that loving? To look at somebody that's headed right toward the cliff and go, well, I let them drive over. Now, if you say to them, hey, you're driving over a cliff, and they say, shut up, I'm going to do what I want. Hey, okay. I mean, that's fine. Truly, it is a fair call. It's not like you didn't say it. But we gotta be people who love truth. And who love. We want to be gracious, loving, and honest. We need to be people who are like, you know what? You can drive off a cliff if you want, you stop by my house for dinner on the way. We don't need to exclude people because we don't. That's what the church has been guilty of, I think. And it's made harder because we have people like Westboro Baptist who, you know, hold the signs at funerals and things. And they claim to be one of us. They claim to be a part of us, and that's a challenge. We need to be loving truth. We need to be loving grace. And by the way, a part of that means it starts here. It doesn't mean we start going, hey, you're going. It means we start with each other going, yeah, no, you told me what I really didn't want to hear, but I needed to anyway. And I tell you what, I won't go to the church down the street. That happens a lot. You know, I didn't like what he said, so I'm leaving. I mean, we got to be people who are like, you know what? Yeah, we all of us, need to hear things that we don't like. We need to love it. We need to recognize it. have spoken. It is a comfort and it is a challenge. But it is the most important reality in our life that our Maker speaks to us. And then we get to this other thing. In verse 1, he has spoken to us through his Son in these last days. That's the phrase there, in these last days. Now, if you're reading that kind of, you know, one-off, just read verse 1 of Hebrews, you might think that means recently, right? That's what, when I read in these last days, I hear somebody say, well, recently, this is the way it's been. But that is a phrase that's used throughout the Bible, right? These last days has a meaning. And I think Tolkien was trying to capture this meaning when he said, there's this scene. Gandalf comes by, I think it's the Two Towers. Gandalf arrives and he's in white, and all of a sudden the white wizard becomes the gray wizard. I think he's talking to Gimli, and Gimli's like, Gandalf? He's like, oh yeah, Gandalf the gray. Well, now I'm Gandalf the white. And he says this, and this is what popped into my head when I read this. He says, I come to you now at the turning of the tide. There's this sense in that line and in that scene as though things are shifting. That there's this monumental change, right? From the days of Sauron to the days of Sauron's defeat. That's what's going on there. And here, these last days mean something heavy. It means something weighty. And if you're not with me quite on that, then verse 2 should prove it. Where it says, he created the world. The writer here does not use the common Greek word. We translate a world, some versions universe. It's not cosmos. That's the Greek word that's often translated world. It's that John 3:16, God so loved the cosmos, right? The word is eons. It's where we get our word eons. It means ages. And what that's pointing to this fact that Jesus is the Lord of the ages. See, if we say he's the Lord of the creation, right, the world, we might be tempted to think trees, rocks, mountains, create. That's what, when we say creation, right, we think created things. Makes sense. But when we say eons, or ages, in which the last age was entered into with the resurrection of Christ, and he's the Lord of the ages, all of them, right? It begins to change the way we understand his lordship. It's larger. See, when he was on the throne, when Genghis Khan ruled, he was on the throne. He ruled over that era. He is the Lord of every culture. He is the Lord of every language. He is the Lord of every human technology, from the first rock that sharpened another rock to the iPad. He is the Lord over the ages, not merely created stuff. He's Lord over all of it. And I think sometimes we think too small. You and I watch the media, we freak out because it's election year, right? Well, Jesus was on the throne when Hitler, Mussolini, and Stalin all took office. He was on the throne when they were born. And when they died, when the Soviet Union fell, and when America rose up out of the colonies, and when America falls, guess who will still be on the throne? Jesus. He is the Lord of the ages, not merely creation, but everything. And see, this matters because it matters with how we parent. Are we seeking to raise good, moral children who will be contributing members of society, of American government? Or are we trying to raise children who will be people who will seek to build the kingdom of God under whatever authority, earthly authority they live in? It matters how we work. Is our work to pay our bills and hopefully some life insurance, right? Or is our work to build a better world for the next seven generations of humanity that will come after us? matters in the way we spend our money? Are we chasing self-pleasure, get what we can get, or are we seeking to leave a legacy long after we go on? And that matters in how, it matters in how we leave the church. Think about it. I mean, do we believe that the way we do it right here, right now, is the only way, is the best way? Are we as good as we can possibly get? We got to be people who are seeking to improve. That might mean a terrible tragedy when we change. But do we want to have what we've had? Or do we want to build something so that our great-grandchildren will inherit a church that is more effective at preaching the gospel and reaching lost people and at discipling them to make them faithful and passionate followers of Jesus? We want to build something that's better at that than what we do right now. Are we looking to the future? See, Christ is the Lord of the ages. He stands above it all, spanning from beginning to end. You and I are just passing through. Like a mist. Says that in another place in the Bible. We are a mist on here today, gone tomorrow. So let me ask you, do you want to get all that you can out of this world while you're in it? Or do you want to figure out what you can contribute to it while you're here? He's the Lord of the ages. He owns it all. What will we do with our time in it? But despite the fact that we're just passing through, we're pretty important. That's it. I want to point out verse 14, and this comes back to the angel issue a little bit. It says, are angels not all ministering spirits sent out to serve for the sake of those who are to inherit salvation? Now, see, what this says is that you and I are the household, really, of God. And the angels are the butlers. They're the ones sent to serve. And they serve us. That's one thing to point here, but there's another thing I want to show you in this verse. Those who are to inherit salvation. This comes from the Greek word. Another Greek word. Mellow. So I think where we get our word mellow, by the way. Chill out. Because it is sort of a chill. And Southerners would translate this fixing to. They are preparing to is not the right word, because when I prepare someone, if I was preparing to go camping, I'd be packing my gear, right? I'd be doing something. This word is more like chilling and waiting. Relaxing until. That's the idea that's being conveyed with our to inherit salvation. Now, this is important on a lot of levels. And so if you bear with me, I'm going to give you a little bit of theology here. It's important, first of all, because as we go through this book, those of you that will be here, I believe, and I think a lot of us here believe, that in this idea of what I call perseverance of the saints, the idea that a person whom Jesus has grabbed a hold of will continue to persevere in that faithfulness until the day Jesus takes them home to the new creation, to heaven and new earth. That belief, though, as we navigate this book, is going to be shaken. There are certain passages here that will make you go, wait a minute, what? And that's okay. It'll be shaken a little. I will help you navigate that as we come to it. This is what's being said and that kind of thing. But one thing that's worth pointing out, and I've said this before, I'm going to say it again. I don't personally like to use the phrase, I got saved, referring to. I don't fight about it, it's not a big deal. But here's why. And again, forgive the theology, but this is important. I think you'll like it. It matters. Salvation, the way we understand it biblically, refers to a sort of scale of things that happen to the person. Essentially, three core elements. Justification is when God says, you are free from the penalty of sin, right? You don't have to suffer because of your sin. Next step, sort of, is sanctification, which is where God says, what that means is you gradually grow in your faith. Some of you that have been walking with Jesus for many years, you will know that There are certain things you used to struggle with that you may not struggle with so much anymore. The idea of sanctification, we begin to grow in our faithfulness. This is where God removes us, removes the power of sin over us. Right? It has a power over us. It's a long, hard process. But that's what it is. And then the third thing that we say, glorification, where God removes us from the presence of sin. This is when we're in the new heavens and the new earth. So, all of that to say, you're not fully saved until that day, until we've been glorified. Now, I want to be clear, Romans 8, it says it better than I can. Those who have been justified will be glorified. That's all. Okay? So, I mean, I'm not going to, that's, but if we're in the middle of this, right, then we're still being saved, right? Okay. Tracking with that. Now, that's important for a couple of reasons. First, I want to point out that for several decades in American contemporary evangelicalism, this is what we taught. If you want to be justified, pray this prayer in the back of the booklet. Oh, if you're justified, you will be glorified. Right? I mean, this is what we taught. So justification was about reading a prayer in the back of the book, someone down front talking at a Billy Graham concert, or a concert. what's he called? Crusade. Thank you. Yeah, that's what got us justified. And all of that, that's not in here, by the way. That's not what this teaches. Jesus has to grab a hold of us. And I think the danger, here's the danger, because I believe there's a lot of people walking around who came down front one time somewhere and are convinced that they get to be glorified now. But their life has never changed one bit. And Hebrews will challenge that idea. But here's the thing I really want to point out that's really in here. Is this idea of mellow, right? He's about to, we're fixing to, we're going to, we're waiting to inherit salvation. If you have a wealthy parent, let's say they're loaded millions of dollars and they're brilliant at investing money, and they live on $15,000 a year, right? It's fair to say you're waiting to inherit a fortune. Now, you haven't inherited it yet. It's not yours, but you will. Of course, that depends on the markets and somewhat on them. Your salvation that you're waiting to inherit is dependent on the character of God and His Word. So it's a little more sure than your inheritance from your parents. That's what we're waiting for. It is a guarantee to us. If we have been justified, if you're in that process, then we are just waiting for that. See, this is important because we've talked a little bit about secularism, right? This idea that we can do this on our own. Essentially, all of these things that we believe, all these things that we hold on to, all these things that we trust in, are based on a way of writing off our personal performance. Secularism will say to us, you're free. Your performance doesn't matter at all. There is no authority, and you can do whatever you please. We're free. Religion, and by that I mean the code and the rules of religion, which most of what this author is speaking to, will tell us your personal performance matters intensely. It is how you get God to smile on you. If you are not doing these steps, then you don't get to go to heaven one day, right? Your personal performance is everything. The gospel, which is what we see here in that word, those who are waiting to inherit it. The gospel says, no, it's all about applying the personal performance of Jesus Christ to your life. It's not about what you do and what you don't do. It's about accepting what Jesus has already done. And that sets us free, but it sets us free not to do whatever we please, but to live lives of people who are loved deeply and passionately by the one who made them. We pray for us. Jesus, Spirit, Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for your presence. Thank you for the work that you continue to do in our lives. Help us to struggle. I struggle all the time to think I'm good enough, to seek to become good enough, to validate myself in a million different ways every day. We do that in opposition to the gospel, that you say, you are mine, and I have made you holy, and I will make you holy, and I will bring you into the new heavens. God, help us to trust in the gospel, and help us to live according to it. Amen.